Hi, and welcome to the Cancer Horizons podcast. Each week, we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals and do what CURE does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Jessica St. Clair and Dan O'Brien may look like a married couple that has it all, with two successful careers and a daughter, Bibi, but their story goes much deeper. Both St. Clair and O'Brien are cancer survivors. In this episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast, the couple describes being diagnosed with cancer consecutively, how being each other's caregivers affected their relationship and parenting, and how they were able to pour their emotions into art forms after processing their trauma.
So first, can you just maybe introduce yourselves, give us some background on what you do and how you guys met?
Well, my name is Jessica St. Clair. I am a comedian, writer, and producer. And we've been married for how many years?
Dan? 15 years.
15 years. We met at Middlebury College in Vermont. I joined an improv comedy group that Dan was already in. And we've been dating ever since. And we have a lovely daughter who's 8 years old. Her name's Bibi, B-E-B-E. Mm-hmm. And right now we are currently in London where I'm shooting a television show for HBO called Avenue 5, a space comedy. And yeah, we're you know, hunkering down and enjoying this pandemic experience. but yeah, and in 2015, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. Stage 2B, and I got a double mastectomy and went through 6 months of chemo. And so, yeah, I'm just
and radiation.
And I'm just about 6 years. I think I passed my 6 year anniversary in September.
That's amazing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. But yeah, I had some of the best doctors probably in the world. Philomena McAndrew was my oncologist at Cedars, and my surgeons were Dr. Leslie Memzik and Dr. Lisa Kaslith, who invented a one-step reconstruction, which was really exciting. So I had my double mastectomy in one surgery, and that was just, they were a real force, all those three women. So I was very blessed to have them. I had a very almost pain-free experience, actually, of surgery and of chemo, because my doctors are so committed to maintaining a woman's life, quality of life while you're going through surgery. So yeah, that's my little spiel. And I wrote a television show about my television show, Playing House, that I wrote with my best friend, Lennon Parham. Playing House, which is on USA, we wrote the final season about our real life, journey through breast cancer. So that was our third and final season. It was about that with a happy ending.
Great. And I'm Dan O'Brien. I'm a playwright and a poet and an essayist, just a writer in general, Jessica's husband, obviously. And I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer on the last day of Jessica's treatment for breast cancer. So we kind of perfectly pivoted from Jessica's experience as a patient to being a caregiver. And in my case, going from caregiver to them being a patient. And I had, I was very lucky in the sense that it was a treatable, even possibly curable form of colon cancer, and had two surgeries, at a colon resection, 4 months of chemo, liver resection, 2 more months of chemo. And I've been no evidence of disease since the end of 2016.
It's amazing to hear both of you are cancer-free. It's incredible. Yeah. Can you bring us through both of your cancer journeys? How did you come to be diagnosed?
So I very randomly and luckily felt the lump because I was only 39. So I had not gotten a mammogram. I had been breastfeeding for like a year and a half. And then I was probably a little late on my OBGYN appointment, my yearly checkup, because I hadn't, I hadn't felt that I had to go. So yeah, I found the lump when I was feeding my daughter Cheerios. I just wasn't wearing a bra and I managed to just feel it. I still to this day don't know why I felt it, but I called my OBGYN. she was truly amazing. And she really did save my life because she said, I'll see you in 2 hours. When she saw me, she did an ultrasound and said, let's, you know, you could wait for, you know, an appointment 3 weeks out at Cedars, or I know of this woman, Dr. Memzik, who founded this breast center, a private breast center called the Bedford Breast Center. And they're around the corner and she'll see you today. And that was the decision that really changed my life, because that day they biopsied it. And by the next Tuesday, I had my diagnosis and I was able to get a lumpectomy, I believe like a couple days later, when we realized it had spread to my lymph nodes, she recommended mastectomy being the most aggressive thing we could do. And that was right in line with what I wanted to do since we had a two-year-old. So I got a one-step reconstruction, which basically is they remove the breast tissue and put an implant in at the same time, as opposed to what is traditionally done, which is you put expanders in and then you stretch the skin and then you have a second surgery where you put the implants in. It was really just such a truly lovely experience. 10 days after my surgery, I was like on the beach with my daughter. It was pretty remarkable. Also, it was my surgeon, Dr. Memzik, pioneered this nipple sparing surgery too. So I kept my nipples, which was really important to me. I didn't realize it at the time, but I'm just so happy I got to. Then Dr. Memzik hooked me up with my oncologist, Dr. Philomene McAndrews, and she's phenomenal. So anyway, Dr. McAndrew took me through chemo. And the really wonderful thing about her practice is she and her nurse practitioners make sure you have like every available supplement, mm-hmm. additional, you know, hydration, access to the numbers of acupuncturists. And they basically throw the kitchen sink at you in terms of managing your symptoms. And so that was really great. I mean, it was still totally not fun to go through chemo, but I felt like I really weathered it to the best of anybody's ability, really. I don't have any lasting neuropathy or anything like that. And then I finished treatment. Dan went into treatment, but I will say also something really important that I did, I wish I had known it sooner, was after Dan was done, I had definite PTSD and it was happening to me and I didn't realize it. And so I finally found a trauma therapist who specializes in somatic therapy, SOMATIC. And it's basically working with the body to calm your body so that tells your brain that it doesn't need to be on fight or flight all the time. So that's been something I'm doing now, but I highly recommend people check that out too after treatment, because after treatment, there's a whole nother kind of journey emotionally. You really need the help, I think, of a medical professional, because it's just too hard to manage that while you're trying to get back to your life.
Dan, yeah. How did that work for you, that timing, really, of receiving your diagnosis right on the last day of her?
It was a nightmare.
Total nightmare.
I think it was, you know, it's a cliche to say something feels surreal, but there is an unreal quality when, I'm sure if a single person, if you're diagnosed with cancer, that feels unreal in the moment. But yeah, to have that sort of happen, you know, sequentially on the day of her final infusion was, yeah, shocking. It seemed absurd. Or numbing, you know, there was also a numbing reaction.
I mean, we were like really angry it was happening to us.
I think the anger takes longer maybe to come out, at least that's true in my case. You know, I think the initial reaction is that fight or flight response. And so, you know, I feel I was very lucky too. We worked with the same group of oncologists at Tower Hematology, which is part of Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills. And, you know, I think in the context of some very bad news, we had some very good news in the sense that the surgeries seemed to be so successful that, you know, at the time, at least, as far as we can tell, our bodies responded so well to the chemotherapy. So, you know, both of us rebel against sort of the cult of toxic positivity around cancer, the idea that, you know, we're around because we did something differently. I do feel like we're here for the most part because of luck and luck in terms of maybe finding the right doctors at the right time. You know, in my case, the surgeon who resected my liver, you know, he told me, what was it, 5 or maybe 10 years ago, you know, they wouldn't have been able to do what they were able to do in terms of the surgery. And even in terms of, I think, the types of chemo and sort of what they've learned about, you know, giving different kinds of chemo and staggering, you know, how they administer it to someone's body. So, you know, I do feel like 10 years ago, it would have been a terminal situation, but they did give me hope from the very beginning. I purposefully didn't Google any sort of survivability rates because I was terrified to see how low that could possibly be. You know, I think I had this easier job in some ways to Jessica, because I was able to feel that she was able to be my coach in a way. You know, I tried to be there for her just as a spouse, a loving spouse, trying to help her through what she was going through. But she had just been through something incredibly similar. And so I was constantly aware of this idea that she was 6 months farther down the trail in a way, or the road, and could tell me, oh, I felt that way. That you're, you know, the way you're feeling today on your fifth round of chemo, well, that's similar to how I felt. And look at me today. I'm up and about and I'm living a normal life. And that was tremendously helpful.
And I would say, though, it was lucky we had each other, but also other people had done that for us. So like these women who were strangers that I, you know, one I met when I was getting a tour of the chemo ward, she was like, oh, I'm on my last treatment. Here's my number. And then like we became incredibly close. And she came, I remember, to my last chemo with a graduation cap. It's like those people exist who can say it's okay. And I remember calling people who were like busy lawyer, like going into trial. And I was like, how are you able to live your life? She's like, oh, I don't even think about this anymore. And mm-hmm. That was so nice for me, even though it seemed unreal and impossible, to know that somebody was living a good life past this was a real light in the dark.
That's why it's so important. It is so important to both of us to you know, write about what we've been through. In my case, with this collection of poetry, Our Cancers, and this essay collection, A Story That Happens, and with Jessica, with her podcast, The Deep Dive, you know, to try to sort of break the taboo, conscious and unconscious, around cancer, and maybe around serious illness in general, and to hopefully be kind of like those people Jessica was talking about, who she could call these strangers who could just, you know, by evidence of their survival, give hope to people. You know, I think so often you hear about people who don't survive cancer. A lot of survivors understandably just want to get back to their regular lives. And it's very important to us, I know to me, to feel like what we've been through might be potentially helpful.
One of our listeners, Deep Dive listeners, had reached out on Instagram and said, you know, her husband had just been diagnosed with what Dan had. And she said, you know, I read every night, I read a couple poems from Dan's collection. And it's the only time all day that I feel less alone, that I don't feel like a freak. Because I think when you're young and you get cancer, it's very isolating, because nobody else, you know, everyone else in your age group is having babies or redoing their kitchen, and you're like fighting for your life. It's very, very isolating. So I feel like I used to Google, you know, happy endings. And there aren't that many. First of all, there's hardly any in TV and movies, because it's not that dramatic for people to survive. And also online, sometimes you can't find those stories, because quite frankly, I think the people who've gotten cured are out there living their lives, you know, and they aren't writing their stories. So that's what's so nice about when you have the chance to be able to tell your story, that people might find and see themselves in it, or see themselves as patients, or see themselves in it as caregivers. It can feel, we hope it feels comforting to know that they're not alone.
You both played a role of patient, and then you both played a role as caregiver as well. What kind of effect did that have on your relationship?
Well, I think being a caregiver, I think it's really, really hard and complicated. I don't feel like people focus on that as much as they should. Everybody is thinking about the patient. Obviously, they're fighting for their lives and they're in a lot of physical pain. But for the caregiver, it's an extreme emotional toll, because you are usually the one doing the housework and the cooking and the cleaning and the caregiving of kids, if you have any. And in addition, you are taking care of another adult person, which is really difficult. And it's and then add to that, you are terrified. But you know that if you share how terrified you are with your partner, then that will make them more afraid. I felt I had to really keep a lot of that to myself, and that can feel really exhausting. And so, yeah, I really felt like I didn't realize how hard it was for Dan to be the caregiver until I was one. can. And yeah, I just think there needs to be more support for caregivers, really. Everyone's dropping off food, but it's like people need to be aware that that's nearing their breaking point.
Yeah, you know, my poetry collection is called Our Cancers because literally we both had cancer. But also because, you know, if one person in any type of relationship, whether it's family or romantic, has cancer, it's a shared experience. You know, it'll differ in terms of specifics, it'll maybe differ in intensity, of course, in some ways. But, you know, when I was the caregiver for Jessica, I felt like I was experiencing it very much with her. And the times when I felt separate from her, that's a different type of stress because you feel like, are you losing touch with this person? Will you lose touch with this person forever? You know, what helped me, the support of a therapist was a huge help during that time. Having somebody to speak to about what I was going through, in addition to friends and family. And then for me, I was able to fall back on what helped me through a difficult childhood, which was my writing, you know, and that's where these poems and this book have been revised for several years, but they're in the rough draft form. They were written during the experience. The first half of the book were written during Jessica's treatment. The second half of the book was written during my own treatment. And, you know, that was a way for me to try to make sense, to try out of the chaos of illness, out of the uncertainty of illness. I'm sure there was a self-soothing or a self-therapeutic aspect to it. But, you know, I remember sharing those poems with Jessica during her treatment as a way to try to overcome what Jessica was talking about, where on one hand, of course, you don't want to burden each other with too much fear or anxiety. But at the same time, you do need to try to keep communication open. You do need to try to keep intimacy alive, you know, emotional, physical intimacy too, and not just sort of wall that all away and shut yourself off from each other. So there were times, I mean, I felt like we probably had to pick and choose the right moments to reveal our fears to each other. But of course, by revealing our fears, it was easier to also talk about what we were hoping for, what we were hoping the outcome would be. And it was a way to, again, keep that bond strong through the experience.
I think couples can get a lot closer through going through this, but it would be crazy to say that it's like every day, you know, you're remembering how much you love that person, because sometimes you're busy, you know, getting angry that you have to prepare a second meal after you've just gotten the kitchen clean. And it's like there are daily things that resentments and anger that is really healthy to have and normal. And I feel like I think something we do in our podcast is talk about those feelings that, you know, that grief brings on that aren't, you know, what you'd find in a greeting card aisle, you know. And so to be able to have somebody, if it's a friend or a family member, that you can like be really honest with about all of your feelings, even the ones that are, you can might feel are shameful, is really important, you know, to be able to share those things. Cause I think a lot of times you'll feel badly. I shouldn't be feeling this way. You know, I'm not the one with cancer. And it's like, no, this is happening to you too, you know. It's equally scary for you. You may even be spending your time thinking, what am I going to do if this person dies? You know, how am I going to survive? So that's a lot.
You had mentioned before you wanted to, I don't know if you used the word hide or not, hide that you were sick from your daughter. How was going through that also as parents, both of you back to back? I mean, that must have been hard on both of you. And then her, like she might have not exactly known, but she's like kids, you never know.
I mean, she was so young. She was really two when Jessica was diagnosed. Yeah, almost two. And then by the time I was finished, she was a little bit more than three. So there were certainly times, especially with my treatment, where we, you know, we had to explain that I had a boo-boo after surgery. But we did try to really keep it from her because it seemed like it was just too difficult for her to understand. And it, you know, it felt, again, yeah, you never know what kids are absorbing emotionally, and we were aware of that. But we didn't want her to have to try to understand the full implications of what we're going through. I mean, I'll say two things. One, on one level, it increased the stakes in a horrible way because you don't want to imagine this incredibly young, vulnerable child losing a parent, or in our case, both parents.
That was the hardest.
That's a terrible, nightmarish scenario. On the other hand, and this side of the equation was more important to me, it gave us so much to focus on in a hopeful and pragmatic way. You know, we talk about hiding, it sounds negative, but there was a pragmatic way to approach that too, which is like we had to get on with life.
Yeah.
You know, we had to
get out of bed.
We had to take care of the house. We had to take care of her. We had to get her to play dates and preschool. And, you know, so it kept us grounded in a way that maybe if we were childless or I was a single person or something, maybe I wouldn't have felt quite as grounded. So, you know, I'm a writer, so I'm comfortable with contradiction. So I can kind of live with those two sides of the issue. But I do feel overall, you know, this is corny, but that I was struggling to live for her primarily. And that was helpful and useful to me. I mean, it might be magical thinking, but it was helpful in the day-to-day for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also our family adopted this motto, heck yes.
Heck yes.
Heck yes life.
Heck yes life.
But my way of getting through my treatment was this motto. And I said, well, any opportunity for joy that we're presented with, we're going to take it. And so, you know, we went to Disneyland the day before my mastectomy because someone invited us. We, you know, we booked this crazy trip to Ireland after Dan's treatment that, you know, we couldn't necessarily afford and had the time of our lives. And I feel like it's really informed us as parents with Bibi, because we really know the secret that life is short and that you should try and enjoy yourself no matter what. We don't live so much for the future as I think we would have had this not happened to us. So I do actually
think live for the future, but we don't defer.
Oh, that's what I meant.
We don't defer joy, or we don't, right. You know, if we can help it. We do try to live as fully in the present as we can. More than I'm sure we were able to do so beforehand.
Right. So I think we are better parents having gone through this, for sure. My heart goes out to people with older children who have to explain it. But I also think like there were a couple nurses actually whose parents had gone through it. And, you know, I think that the assumption that it would really mess up a kid is also not true. Mm-hmm. Because I think they can see their parent as really strong, you know, and having survived something, you know.
And every child sees parents engaging with a struggle or more than one struggle. And what's important is hopefully what maybe you're able to teach them by what you model of how you meet that challenge and how you meet that struggle.
Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, I don't know how this fits in, but I had another listener of the podcast write in to say that they had just been, she was like 34. She'd just been diagnosed with kidney cancer. And she said, I don't have a great family structure, like a extended family, but my friends have said, how can I help? And I don't know what to do. Can you give me some guidance? So what I have said is we actually were blessed with this incredible network of friends. They were like, we didn't make a meal for a year. I mean, they went above and beyond. And I know not everybody has that, but I do think most people have a few people that really want to help. And the thing that you have to do is to actually tell them what you need. It's not like they, you know, people, I think something that we forget is that people really want to be of use and of help, but you need to give them the tools. So I was very directive with my friends. You know, once I got over asking for help, I really got very good at saying, this is what your superpower is as a friend. You know, I have my friend Danielle, who I know loves to take adventures on the weekend. And I didn't want to be with Bibi by myself on a weekend because I didn't feel well enough to totally be myself. So I said, every Saturday, I want you to make free for me so we can go on an adventure. And she did that. That was something I knew she'd be good at. And then I have an organization friend who I knew would be great coming with me to some appointments. You know, so I would just say, think about who you have in your life. And then you have to be like a military general and kind of farm out the tasks that you need done, because there is no prize for being a martyr. And in fact, if you want to be really successful at this treatment, you want to reserve all of the energy you have to fighting cancer, not to, you know, figuring out what to serve for dinner if someone is willing and able to help you with that.
Dan, you talked about your books, and then Jessica, you talked about your shows and how your cancer journey and survivorship inspired that. Can you talk about that maybe a little bit more and how other survivors can use their journey to inspire them also?
as I alluded to before, I feel like I survived a really difficult childhood by finding a way to first just privately put into language the experience of trauma, you know, and I think anybody can do that. In some ways, it's a private therapist, you know, it's the first step in terms of processing some really difficult emotions is just putting those feelings into words, you know. It just so happened in my case that I went on to then become a professional writer, but you know, anybody obviously can do that. And it might be much easier at first than actually, you know, going to speak to a therapist or joining a support group or that sort of thing. But I would encourage people to not, of course, stop there. But yeah, storytelling, you know, it's fundamental to what I do for a living, what Jessica does for a living too, is that storytelling is just so important. You know, my view of trauma is that it can obliterate your sense of self. You know, who you thought you were before the trauma is suddenly something happens to you. That's why the essay collection is called A Story That Happens. You know, this idea that something uncontrollable seems to change your life, maybe forever. And one way through it, a fundamental way through it, is to reconstruct your identity, reconstruct or construct for the first time a narrative that makes sense of your life, your new life as it's changing, a positive view of your life. And again, that's not just to be positive or toxic positivity, but constructing a view of your life story that contains room for a future, for future joy and future love. So creativity of any kind is really, I think, fundamental to recovery.
It's a great way, I think, to tap into the emotions that are underneath it all, because I think when you're doing something like art or dance or even exercise, it's like your conscious brain can take a break.
Because of the life and the career we'd had, that meant, you know, writing books or writing a TV show, you know, but for anybody, I think the question is, well, what can you do to help people, connect to people, create connection, create support? Because of course, that sense of support and connection is going to come back to you. So in our case, it happened to be writing a collection of poetry or writing a book of essays, or Jessica, you know, writing an entire season of her TV show about her experience or this new podcast. But for anybody else, it could be, you know, it could be through teaching, it could be through activism.
Or even one-to-one, like, you know, we had Julia Louis-Dreyfus on our podcast who went through breast cancer after me. And one of the things we talked about is how good it feels to help somebody. It's, again, just like I was talking about going to your community of friends and saying, this is what I need you to do for me. It benefits both the person helping and the person getting the help.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.